This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
Good evening. This is Dr. Mark McNaught with Building the Scottish State. And I have the great pleasure to have with me Michelle Thompson with me this evening to speak about whatever comes up.
Good evening, anyway.
Thank you. Anyways, thanks for being with us. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about in the information I sent you about the digital covenant, which we've been developing, and in addition to the wiki.scottishconstitution.com site. And the idea for the covenant was basically, as you know, there was a covenant done back in the early 1950s where they got something like 2 million signatures in the paper age. And I don't know how many months it was collected over, but they managed to get 2 million signatures basically to end the union and to have to chart their own constitutional path. And it was safely ignored by Westminster. I mean, and so there isn't even that much information about it. If you go to the digitalcovenant.scot website, which where I encourage all of you to go and sign if you haven't already, it has the wording of the covenant, which is very similar to the one that that was done back in the 1950s, but kind of updated. But the idea was that we know that, you know, the British state does not easily let one of their biggest cash cows go. I mean, we see that throughout history. I mean, there's a reason that Great Britain had such a massive empire because of their double dealing, their cruelty, given that Scotland has so many natural resources, is a place to park the nukes and has such a massive oil. I mean, all of the massive natural resources that Scotland has, they're not going to let it go that easy. I certainly don't expect Boris Johnson to issue a Section 30 order. Then it's possible that they could wind up in the UK Supreme Courts, and Westminster sovereignty prevails, as always. And it's very possible that wind up in the courts and then they could turn it down and that would just prolong things. The idea behind the covenant was to have basically a citizens' grassroots backstop, whereby hopefully within the coming months that we can get 2.2 million signatures on it in favor of independence. Now, this covenant is blockchain based, which means that people have to get on the site, you download a valid ID and proof of address, then we verify it. And then once it's verified, then it can be committed to the blockchain. You get a very long transaction code, something like 25 letters and numbers. I mean, completely unbreakable. And it is irrefutable proof that you signed the document. And then once the sufficient numbers of signatures are collected, we basically hand it over to the Scottish government and say, look, it is the will of the people to become independent. It is very much our intention not to do anything at cross purposes with the Scottish government, and whatever transpires with regard to an independence referendum, et cetera, they're welcome to do. But it's just that there's so much uncertainty. Of course, compounding that is the fact that the hard Brexit is definitely in the cards. And post that, I mean, it could be Armageddon. I mean, food shortages, medicine shortages. I mean, it's just incalculable how bad it could be. What I've been tweeting about, what I've been trying to, you know, get it to draw attention to, is if the Scottish government just came out and said, we will declare independence once this threshold is reached. That would mean that they wouldn't need to campaign. They wouldn't have Westminster breathing down there. The signatures are already being collected. So if they were to say, okay, we'll declare independence when 2.2 million signatures are reached, then it's in the bag. People would sign it, especially if the Scottish government said, yes, this will be the means to achieve independence. Because anything else, I mean, if we wait till after the end of this year, all bets are off. Westminster has the technical authority to abolish the Scottish Parliament. They're already setting up civil service offices for British civil servants to take over all of these powers that are supposedly being repatriated. And it's really scary. Do you see that as something that the Scottish government could embrace? Because I haven't really gotten any reaction to them whatsoever, from them whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, genuinely, I would say that the likelihood of them saying, that's a good idea, we'll sign up to it and progress it, is the square root of zero. And I would say that because the First Minister in particular is very focused on the so-called gold standard of referendums, i.e. the agreement of a Section 30 order and a similar type referendum. And she's on the record of saying that consistently. Yeah. However, there's two aspects that are of interest to me. The spirit of what you're trying to do in terms of legitimacy and ways that people in Scotland can make their voices heard, multi-layered ways, if you like, of which I would agree this is another potential way, along with many others, and I've got some ideas about that as well, and also the democracy element, because the obvious question, if I was sitting at home listening to this, exactly as you said, well, you can get lost with your Section 30 order, off you go home, we're not giving you it. But I do agree with the stance that's been taken. Over time, it becomes a progressively more untenable democratic just outrage. And we are used to hearing our own voices and often agreeing with each other, where we find it the most blatant affront, really shocking, just, you know, I mean, it makes me as angry as it makes everybody else, but we're kind of not the point. The people that are the point are the people who, not at the extremes of unionism, no matter what happened, would the existentialist unionists, if you like, we've got plenty of existentialist Scottish nationalists, but the people in the middle who may have been quite uncertain in 2014, who over time are starting to be challenged at the level of their values, where they're seeing what's happening in Westminster and thinking, this is not right, this is not proper, it's not fair, and whisper it within that grouping, there will even be some old-fashioned Scottish Tories. And the more you can start to separate out and get them on side, the better. Because from a legitimacy point of view, that is really, really going to add to majority. So we need to keep the people we've already got, and that's not particularly easy. And we need to get new people on board as well through a variety of means. So I welcome that as another way, but I think the chances of the Scottish Government adopting it are very, very low.
Why? It strikes me as just something that it should be self-evident. I mean, obviously, I've been involved in this project for a while, and I've obviously we've sold ourselves on it, but it would be giving them a means to become independent for the end of the year.
But, I mean, I think the feeling is that from a legitimacy point of view, Nicola Sturgeon is on record as saying, and much talk has been made about the so-called gold standard granting of a Section 30. And I think the concern is about international legitimacy. Now, I fully accept and understand that if you look at the history of how independence has been achieved in other countries, it's not necessarily the usual route that, I mean, there's been some serious kind of bloodbaths where this has come about. I am merely noting that that is the view, as far as I understand it, of the SNP and of the Scottish Government. That is their view. And I think it's therefore a legitimate question to ask. And it is one that I am happy asking, given the likely refusal of a Section 30. What specifically are the strategies that can and therefore should be adopted to start to shift the dial so that the fatal lack of democracy becomes untenable? And I think genuinely that other routes must be considered. You know, there was much talk for a while and continues to be about a so-called Plan B, of which there are several Plan Bs. But a Plan B, a Plan C, a Plan D, and general terms, I applaud things that the ordinary people can do as well to make their voices heard. And so I think the initiative you're following fits into that, but it's only part of that.
Yeah, I fully understand the point about international legitimacy, but international law is very neutral on the ways in which independence can be achieved, and because we consulted with international lawyers, and as long as it's peaceful, sometimes it isn't, obviously, but if it's peaceful, and there is a demonstrated majority for independence, for self-determination, which, as we all know, is one of the first rights given in the UN Charter, then, you know, again, it is definitely a potential alternate route. It's just, and I'm just trying to, you know, get the word out about that so that people, maybe somebody does actually recognize it as a legitimate way. There's certainly nothing illegal about it.
Yeah, and again, international law may well say one thing or another, but I think that the feeling is that legitimacy and what constitutes legitimacy, maximum legitimacy here. I mean, in some respects, there are good reasons for it. The last thing we want to see is people were talking about last week, the sort of so-called Ulsterisation of Scottish politics, where we know we've got extremes at both sides of the equation, where some of the behaviours being adopted are becoming increasingly vitriolic. You know, we wouldn't want to go down that route. But the international law, Schminternational law, you know, I think the drive is about maximum legitimacy, that no matter where, everyone agrees that this has been a democratically, peacefully expressed will of the Scottish people. And I would use the example when the Scottish Parliament passed the bill for gay marriage, that really, universally, the feeling was one of great warmth and pleasure that that happened. But whisper it a bit, that was what took us so long. So evident it was that, well, of course, you know, gay people would want to get married. It was so evident. And maybe the thinking is getting to that stage. So if you look at the events, the counter-democratic events coming down the track, I mean, you correctly allude to Brexit being dragged out of Europe against our will, and then potentially calamitous, chaotic Brexit at the end of January. What will that do for the free-thinking people who were no voters, of which there were many in 2014, who believed the line about being taken out of Europe? All of this adds democratic weight. And of course, we did have the pronouncement in the programme for a government about pulling forward a referendum bill in this parliament for enactment in the next, and indeed the specification of a date when that will occur. It interests me, the strategy and thinking behind that is the idea that it piles pressure on the democracy, that that must be allowed. And of course, coupled with that, a massive vote for the SNP in the Scottish parliamentary elections. And in all honesty, I mean, I don't know the thinking behind that. And I found myself wondering, particularly about the date element, because the question side of it is largely set, whether the Tories like it or not. And of course, the franchise element, who gets to vote, is also set. That these things have already been agreed. So it's interesting. And I think the other thing I would add into the mix is that for anybody to call the series and sequence of steps would be unwise, because we don't know what is coming down the track in terms of post-COVID economic, but we know it's going to be bad. We know it's going to be bad, and so bad that it just seems obscene that we will have people who cannot eat. It's just shocking. That's another thing to factor into it. And of course, the winding down of the furlough scheme, which has already started, terminating at the end of October, is simply going to throw a lot of people that have been hanging on by their fingernails into penury. So there's going to be a lot of different variables in a very complex situation. That is hard to read, and I wouldn't like to be the one that predicts it.
Okay. One of the questions from Faye Kennedy, how are we going to ensure there's no rigging in another vote? And that is a huge reason that we have produced this covenant, because it will, even after being able to have a 100% verifiable majority in favor of independence, it simply cannot be tampered with. I don't know what happened in 2014, but I mean, there's absolutely no way that you can affirm its legitimacy. I did some research on the way, and they had the Scottish Independence Referendum Act that was passed by the Westminster Parliament to enable the referendum in 2014, and they had clauses in there like, you know, the private companies that store the ballots have to destroy them after 3 months. I mean, what's that? Whereas with the blockchain signatures, they're permanent. They can be verified in perpetuity. There can be no question about it. So even after as we develop this, the signatures, that can also be used as a basis for self-sovereign identity and many other, you know, huge advances in blockchain democracy that it could be seen. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but that's the thing. If it's done under the rules, because they are legislating for the franchise, does that mean that the referendum will be done under those rules? Because you have the Scottish Electoral Commission that normally operates under Westminster rules, and they ran it last time. They hired out private companies to run everything. And if there wasn't fraud, there was massive scope for fraud. And so that's why I'm saying the legitimacy of a paper-based vote could be brought into doubt as well.
There's certainly ways that we can improve our democracy, and I can see how blockchain offers some opportunity there. I mean, we're quite behind the times in how we do our democracy here.
But to be fair, most of the world is. I mean, you have some, Finland, I think, has electronic voting, and you have some other ones, but there's other countries that are beginning to adopt it. Nothing on any kind of scale, because, you know, the ruling elites wouldn't want it, because it would be a true representative of public opinion rather than them being able to fix and...
I mean, I suppose, assuming that we've got the same system as we have now, because the pace of change goes very, very slowly in these areas. I mean, I would personally favour having international observers, in fact, I would have preferred to have seen that last time. I actually did a course in international observation of elections through Westminster Foundation for Democracy, and I found it really very interesting, the kind of things that they look for, and they send, I mean, I've never done that. I simply did the course to learn a bit about it. But, you know, they send, the various agencies send people all around the world. I would certainly be in favour of that. I'm looking forward, yes, of course, blockchain offers in the terms of whole statecraft, huge potential, absolutely huge potential. And I suppose the interesting thing for me is how we might be able to use that when we are independent, because there's certain things that we'll want to be able to do incredibly quickly and effectively and accurately without fraud. But again, it's, you know, everything's going at a different pace. It's not just the pace of the technology and the security of it. It's also the pace of people kind of getting to grips with it, because again, we're talking about this quite comfortably, and yet there are still people who sign checks and don't use email.
Exactly, and it certainly is. It's a challenge to get everybody wired. Jack Gibson, is the digital covenant not the closest thing to Scottish sovereignty available to the people of Scotland? I would agree, but I think the mentalities are still very much stuck in the paper age, that these things have to be done. But, oh, well, my old granny wouldn't do that, or she wouldn't trust it. And I do understand that, but with the advantages of this type of voting and also the signatures, fraud is virtually impossible, and you can check it in perpetuity, and you can see all the other signatures without seeing who actually signed it, because there's a very, very long transaction code. So how do you think we can get over these kind of mentalities that are kind of resistant to...
You probably didn't see it where you are. There was a report which was accepted by the Scottish Government and commissioned, called the Logan Report, about how you advance tech and create tech clusters and so on in Scotland. And I'm glad it was, but within that, it was commenting that the teaching of IT, computer science, it was expressing it as important as maths and English. And I agree with, and the way we teach it favours its sort of bias towards boys rather than girls. And of course, we see that in the figures, the uptake of technology. I think we need to put far more emphasis on it. And if you think about us in Scotland, that is one of the things that we're already recognised as a centre of excellence. Some of the gaming work, for example, that's gone on in Dundee. Yeah. And this is something we can really, really push. And incidentally, assuming that we are going to be more restricted, at least for a period of time post-Brexit, the services that we can sell all around the world in the form of technology, we can reach anywhere, and indeed we should be reaching anywhere. So I personally favour a very internationalist outlook in using technology as an enabler to get Scotland, the brand, out to the rest of the world and some of the great services we've got. If people have not had a chance to read the Logan Report, I would go and have a look at it. And I think it's exciting, very challenging to implement, extremely challenging, but I think that's the sort of thing we should be looking at. I think tech is vital, especially for girls.
The only thing is I really fear that if Scotland goes beyond the end of the year without, you know, becoming independent in some way, that all bets are off. I mean, you've seen what Westminster is capable of. I mean, how do you see that? If on the 1st of January, I mean, the UK government basically abolishes or completely defangs the Scottish government, it looks like they're going to do that. I mean, you know more than anybody of what Westminster is capable of. How do you see it? How do you see it potentially playing out?
Again, you know, we touched on this earlier, there's a kind of scales of democracy and there's a tension between what is happening in Scotland and Westminster. So yes, Westminster could do a great many things, but they must be asking themselves if they should do certain things. And in some respects, maybe our movement is starting to come of age in terms of when you look at the number of events like this going on, the education, we've got a highly articulate, educated populace that have carried on from 2014. So the question is, what would we do that asserts our will, asserts our rights, that is non-violent? And I think we need to start looking more and more at things. And funnily enough, I had a conversation with John McNally the other day, who's the MP for Falkirk. Mm-hmm. And I was explaining to him about the singing revolution in Estonia. And at one point, there was half of the population singing at any one point. Now, that might seem to some people like, what's that all about? But when we look at how we've got a yes choir, we receive our music quite passively. We sit politely and we listen whilst the choir projects out. I think we should be singing. I would be in favour of now starting the competition to get some funky young dude to write as a new Scottish national anthem, create a competition, get some funding and get people to vote in it, and we all learn it and we all sing it wherever we go so that you feel that expression of voice. Now, look, I don't imagine for a minute, that sounds hopelessly naive, that Boris Johnson will be sung out of Scotland. They'll go, oh, well, that's fine then. Yes, thank you for that four-part harmony. That's really changed my mind. I'm not suggesting that. What I am saying is that we need to get more creative with the ways by which we express our will and our appetite. So, for example, the All Under One Banner marches, you will hear some people say, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, you should be out canvassing and campaigning. And of course, the truth is, yes, of course you should, but why shouldn't you celebrate and build companionship with people who are of a like mind and whilst at the same time show how strong the support is? And what I say to people when I'm talking to them, well, if you're committing that the number of hours you gave up walking through the streets and making your voice heard, enjoying your day out, if you are spending the equivalent or double or treble the amount of hours to convince people about the future, where the future is yes, then definitely. It's not one or the other, but we need to get more creative about ways, I think.
Okay. See, how are we going to get the digital covenant out to the masses? I have an answer for that. The long walk to freedom is being organized. It is 1,300 some miles. There are two different marches, all completely COVID compliant. We're scrupulously following the guidelines on it. And any changes in the guidelines from the Scottish government will be reflected in the Long March to Freedom. But that's kicking off on the 18th of September, exactly the date of the 2014 referendum. And yeah, it's just its initial stages, but it's something that's going to last several weeks, pass through every town in Scotland or nearby. So that's in the planning stages right now. But as I said, be assured that we are following every COVID-related regulation on this march. And it's obviously plenty of room for social distancing.
Since I can see the questions as well, I know you're the... There's an interesting one here that jumps out at me about your views by Robert Knight, your views on the establishment of free summer schools on our system of democracy aimed to be the encouragement of young people in civic affairs. That is definitely something I would strongly agree with. And it's not just our democracy in terms of our view of the Constitution. It's about understanding more the historical nature of Scotland and what it's given to the world in democracy. So, for example, you're from the United States. What we contributed to the formulation of the United States, principles under which it's enshrined. And yet I am willing to bet that there are hardly any young people who understand what we fundamentally of how democracy and the best principles in the world understand that came from Scotland, understand about why it's such a big thing for Scotland that we do have a society, some of our best thinkers from the Enlightenment. So it's not just about our democracy. I mean, although we do now have a historical component in history in schools, I mean, I know when I was growing up, I was never taught any Scottish history, but it wasn't just Scottish history. It was our way of thinking and seeing the world, which when you talk to people around the world, and when you talk to people, Scots who have left these shores and live elsewhere, they realise it's a pretty unique way of thinking and seeing the world that is far, well, certainly was far ahead of its time. So, no, I think that's a great idea. I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah, because when I was growing up in the States, you know, we had a both in high school, it was mandatory to have a course on the, you know, on government, basically the system of the checks and balances and, you know, system, division of powers. Yeah. Not that that's pretty much shot right now under Trump, but you know, we did learn about it and it helped inform us to become, you know, a better citizens. But it seems to me as if I know that people in like A levels can do politics, but and learn, I guess, some of the basics. But for most people, they don't really get any education. And when you're studying Westminster, it's not real pretty, you know. No, so.
And politics is, you know, so a lot of people will say, I'm not interested in politics. And then you ask some questions about would they be interested if they fell down a hole in the road because somebody hadn't put a manhole cover? Would they be interested if suddenly their tax rate was trebled overnight? You could list a whole lot of things, say, well, yes, you are interested in politics. And what you've said about the kind of relative layers of politics is generally an extremely poor understanding of the relative layers. So, for example, most people don't understand the difference between the role of a councillor and a member of the Scottish Parliament or an MP in the Westminster Parliament. They don't understand that councillors are, in essence, administrators, that the primary legislation is created in Holyrood or Westminster. And therefore, the skills required for that kind of candidate are around strategic thinking, policy, national policy making, and so on. And they're slightly different for a councillor, but people don't understand that. And they're not really taught it. I'm of the mind that we can find a hip and funky and engaging way to teach politics to young people because it's our politics and it's really, really very important. It's important now because we are in this constitutional debate. It will be even more important, arguably, after we're independent because these are people that will come after us that have more skin in the game. You know, I'll never live to see the best benefit of Scottish independence, but we want them all contributing. And I think politics is hip and funky, but that's maybe just me.
And you say, well, the United States less so now.
things are so skewed. And Westminster is truly appalling. And the more I see of Rees Mogg and his sanctimonious hectoring, it just appalls me. And it takes pleasure out of living in another century.
I wanted to talk a little bit about that because in the time that I've been involved in this campaign, so basically since 2011, when I heard that Scotland would be having a referendum, I'm like, cool. They could use a written constitution rather than that. This is my quote, but the British constitution, not worth the paper it's not written on. So
the claim is flexible, make it up as you go along.
Exactly. And it worked for a while when there were sort of these norms that were respected, but those are just out the window. I mean,
yes. Uh-huh. And of course, you know, what's happened both in the States and here is that these old rules of gentleman's agreement, as you would call it, and a mutual understanding, they've all been ripped up.
Exactly. And the US Constitution, that brings me on to my wiki.scottishconstitution.com, which I've been developing for basically since 2011. Because what I did was, when I heard that there would be this referendum, I emailed all of the MSPs at the time and said, hey, you know, it'd be good if you do become independent, you should have a written constitution. And I got in touch with John Drummond and Elliot Bulmer. I came over a few times and worked with them, and then I took one of the Eliot's draft constitution, and then I I took it as a basis, but I wanted to bring a constitution into the digital age. You know, for example, the United States, I mean, it was written in 1789. You know, most of the founding fathers were slave owners. The Senate was basically the body of the owners, the landowners, and they weren't even elected. The House of Representatives was elected, but only by like 6% of the population. You had to be a white male landowning Christian in order to be part of the franchise. And so, I mean, the idea that it was like this started out as this great democracy is just absurd. You know, I've got a doctorate in American politics, and, you know, I used to teach a class on campaign finance in the United States. It's the kind of studying that you have to go vomit in the toilet every once in a while when you're doing research, because it's just so phenomenally corrupt. And so that was what drove me a lot in writing wiki.scottishconstitution.com, was the idea of just having a non-corrupt government. And so just one for example, under this constitution, all policy must be based on empirically verifiable evidence. You can't just get some garbage from a think tank and put it in policy. It has to be, you know, it has to be real. It has to be genuine studies rather than just these weird assertions that often come from the think tanks. And so just things like that, that would maybe a certain amount of human corruption is always inherent in any political system. But the more you can do on the constitutional side to make corruption very much difficult, you know, all the better. Also, as you see, because we were speaking earlier about, you know, being a legislator, and, you know, and I've read many of the Scottish laws and Westminster laws and stuff, and they're absolutely impenetrable. I mean, just the referendum law that they're doing, I read through that. I mean, it's just so complex. And how can you be a good citizen if you don't have access to what the law actually is? And also it avoid, you know, when the law is clear and clearly written, understandable to any layman, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand it. And that also protects the individual as well from being needlessly persecuted by the judiciary, which we've seen with Craig Murray and Alex Salmond and others. So, you know, so the basis of this corpus of Scottish law that you can go and see on wiki.scottishconstitution.com is that the Constitution specifies that all laws need to be written in the clearest, most comprehensible wording possible, using the simplest terminology possible, so that everyone can understand, and they can, you know, there can be genuine popular input into the construction of the law. So it is no longer the purview of the civil service to write incomprehensibly impenetrable laws, and that everybody can just, okay, what's the law on this? Okay, all right, and then you can do it yourself. You don't necessarily have to hire a lawyer to get something done, because it says how to do it. That was my logic behind it. And so when we've taken the citizenship, the people signing the digital covenant, we can merge that with this constitutional system in order to build a truly digitally based governance, which can leapfrog everybody. There has to be the political will to actually engage in it, but we're building it no matter what.
So your comments about the law are interesting. I suppose my view would be it cannot be that simple. When you try and explain some obvious legal scenarios to somebody, we all seek yes or no answers. But of course, unfortunately and invariably, the answer is often, it depends. Right. And then you start to explore, well, it depends on what? And then you have to start to qualify and qualify and qualify. And you can find innumerable examples. So I think that often legislation is complex for a good reason. So I'm going to gently disagree.
There's no reason it can't be complex, but the idea that it can be written in the simplest way possible. Because yeah, you've seen legalese. I mean, it's absurd. And it's necessary sometimes. I'm not disputing that. But other times it can be written in a much more clear fashion.
I think sometimes it can. And of course, there's a style of language which is understood by lawyers and has years and years and centuries of precedent behind where it's been tested. What exactly does that phraseology mean? The one area where I think that, because there are sort of legal systems where obfuscation and complexity has been deliberately allowed to creep in, of which tax law is incredibly complicated in the UK. I'm sure it's equally complicated in the US. But of course, the tax law has been allowed to become complicated, because that is where the wriggle room is provided for people to avoid paying tax. And when you look at the ridiculous amount of tax that's not collected in the UK and is filleted away offshore, of which I'm sure that is only increasing exponentially, particularly as we go up to Brexit and will be a free-for-all after that, is absolutely ridiculous. And if you look at the kind of sums that could be available for public expenditure. So in that respect, I think that's been a deliberate obfuscation. But I think in many areas, people would argue that it is complex for a reason, because it is complex. Mm-hmm. So again,
if Scotland becomes independent, they can simplify it, prevent offshore.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think there needs to be some bold moves. I mean, I don't hear enough people talking about some of the protective measures we will need to take when we become independent. So for example, we hear that, you know, there'd be a flight of capital. In actual fact, it's my view that there would be an inflow of capital, because many of Scotland's assets are relatively good value if you took an investor perspective. Yeah. And I wouldn't want a lot of speculators coming in and indeed being allowed to buy up assets that should be protected for the Scottish people in perpetuity. And I'd like to hear more of thinking about that. And of course, we have a chronic issue with the land in Scotland.
I was just going to get to that, because in the Constitution, it says that all land has to be registered with the Scottish government, or else it becomes public land. Because as you well know, in the Scottish system, you have the Register of Seizine, you know, the registry of seized land that was just taken from people and people expelled. From what I understand, the Registry of Seizine, you can see it, but you have to pay for it to look at it. In its physical description, you know, you go from the rock over there to the river over there, to the tree over there, and that's the land boundaries. And these
rock, the trees long since rotted away, and somebody secretly
exactly.
moved. Yeah, I mean, there is a chronic issue in the land, and we have an issue as well in terms of the whole looseness around how we record that. You're absolutely right. I don't think that should be allowed. I think some of these things we should be attempting to find ways to stop right here, right now. My now business partner and former colleague when we were in Westminster, Roger Mullen, kind of fought a strong campaign against the use of Scottish limited partnerships, which are a very, very loose vehicle that besmirches our good name, our good ethical business name around the world, because basically got hardly any kind of transparency around them, and they're used willy-nilly for all kinds of dodgy deals and so on. And I think there needs to be a tightening around that. And I personally also would like to see the Law Society of Scotland doing much more. Their view on it at that time, as I understand it, was fairly relaxed, presumably because a lot of their members were making a lot of business from it. I think we need to be much more sensitive to their brand, because Roger, through Momentous Change, we did some research into the sentiment of our Scottish global diaspora, which you can look at, you can draw down free off the Momentous Change website, because the client was entirely happy we published it. But one of the comments that was being made from people all around the world, Scots, diaspora Scots, or affinity Scots, if you like yourself, in effect.
Sure. Well, I consider myself more Scottish than anything else, but
you know. Yeah, we're commenting on how the ethics and the reliability and the trust factors associated with how Scots undertake their business, how much of an asset that was around the world. And I'd like to see people like the Law Society of Scotland being aware that that actually is a critical thing that enables us to up and sell around the world. Talking about IT earlier. So I think some of our agencies, like the Law Society, need to be thinking much more innovatively about their kind of role. He's gone away, everybody. I'm just gonna crack on and oh, you're back.
I'm sure you're more than capable.
There's an interesting question here from JB Whitesnake on Periscope. How does the Scottish government stop Westminster stripping powers from the Scottish court? And probably everyone will be aware of this. In a fit of pique after the success of the Brexit cases that went through the courts, they want to look at the remit
Judicial review, right.
Abuse, yes. Uh-huh. And I mean, already you've seen Joanna Cherry, who, again, in my view, is playing a blinder, challenging that. But that goes back to my point about where are the law society in this. I read Scottish legal news every single day and haven't seen a mention of their concerns in that. And I find it impossible to believe that the Law Society of Scotland would be so asleep at the wheel. They think, well, that's okay, you just go right ahead. I can't believe that lawyers would be happy about that. And salute Joanna Cherry. She will be like a terrier progressing this, but it cannot just be Joanna. And again, it goes back to my thing about understanding our power. If you're a lawyer in Scotland and you're already seeing a progressive, you know, you've got much more amalgamation law firms, there's far less laws that can be made. A lot of them are made in Westminster and many of them are starting to undermine some of the core things. I think you should be deeply concerned about this. I think you should be progressing it. It's an assault on the fabric of your profession. So I know Joanna will put a shift in this, but we need much more people to get stuck into this issue as well, because again, it's all about limiting power. We need more power, not less.
I know, but if this, by if Scotland is not out, or at least, you know, clearly March's intention by the end of the year, to be out by the end of the year, it would just seem to be an amazingly wasted opportunity of historic proportions if they didn't take on board the covenant as a way to get out before the end of the year. I don't know if history would forget. I'm not trying to be self-aggrandizing because I'm one of the people that organized it, but this is a ticket out, you know, if they embraced it. But I mean, I guess we just need to keep up the popular pressure on the Scottish government to embrace it, because otherwise,
you know, there's some fantastic initiatives going on and you start to see them. We are in effect in yes campaigning mode. One of the great things we have at our disposal is the knowledge that, you know, people have built on. I mean, there's many people that I met during the first independence referendum, like Kevin, in fact, who runs Indie Live, who has carried on and basically devoted their life to carrying on progressing this. So I think getting out there and informing people. So if we look, for example, at the Internal Markets Bill, and obviously the Scottish Government produced a paper about that, one of the things that makes it difficult for people is that they don't yet have the narrative of what does it mean for me? How will it hurt me or my family? And I would actually say even the SNP themselves don't necessarily always get that pitch right about why should I care? And so I think formulating that narrative of what it means to me. And so you've got groups like I like something off Scotland the Brand today, who in fairness to them, they've been consistently promoting the issues, particularly with Brexit, what it could mean for Scotland's premium products. And again, people can still other that, all right, yeah, okay, well, you know, I never get the chance, frankly, to kind of eat that sort of food. So I think we also need to get better at that, at making these stories real for people and getting out there. And it's so heartening to see on Saturdays, you know, it's quite common if I'm walking about places that I'm seeing more and more stalls springing up that people can explain that. I personally feel, and of course you'll be aware, I've put myself forward to try and be selected as a potential candidate for Falkirk East for the Holyrood elections. And I genuinely feel I am on full-time campaigning mode for the next independence referendum, and I will not stop. I will not stop. This is what I want to do all of the time, and to persuade as many people as I possibly can by the use of my knowledge.
Right. A couple other ones. Kilted One, Digital Covenant. Old people know how to use an app. The majority now have a basic understanding of and own a smartphone. A digital app would be a simpler way of them being able to make an informed vote. My 70-year-old father is planning on signing up ASAP because I've explained its idea, potential, and use to him. All it needs is mass marketing in a clear and informed way so people can understand it. The 1320 Long Walk to Freedom will do most of the groundwork if its plans works out, but the rest of us just need to explain to those that don't get it when the conversation arises. You know, there are people that say, oh my, all this blockchain's so difficult to understand. But at the base, it just means it's secure, and it's a secure signature that can't be hacked. And so, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't think it's difficult to understand. I mean, let's face it, who
doesn't understand signing a document?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was quite an early adopter of IT. I went off and did a postgraduate diploma in IT, I think, when I was in my sort of 20s, which is quite unusual at that time generally. And it was quite unusual for a woman to do that. And I remember my kind of first...
What year was this roughly?
Right, okay, here we go. Now you're... It would have been 1990?
Okay.
Yeah, I think 1990 in Dundee. Because I'd been a musical director in a theatre and kind of composer in residence. And the old-fashioned way is like actually writing the docs and the stave and all the rest of it. And I started using kind of tech equipment, samplers and synthesizers to kind of produce sounds. And you had BBC kind of tapes of owls and things like that and sampling them and starting to splice and have a bit of fun of it. And my thinking at that point was technology was so pervasive that I wanted to go and learn about it. But the point I was going to make was that I knew I was unusual when I got my first job and the system was run on something called TSO. That was like the kind of front. And I said, you know, what does TSO stand for? And the person said, nobody cares what it stands for. You just use it. It stands for time shared operator, I think. Yeah. But, you know, you would just use it. So I was kind of quite unusual going, well, what's under the covers? You know, so I do agree with that. We don't care as long as it works and it's easy to use.
Yeah, exactly. A couple more from Robert Knight. Thanks indeed, Michelle, for your support for young people's summer schools. It's an area close to my heart from my days in community education. Yes, Bears Den in Milngavie with Clyde Bank.
Milngavie.
That's one of the classic. Sorry to butcher it.
Billy Connolly, but you know, pronunciation of Milngavie.
With Clydebank and Milngavie constituency, where you used to live, needing a new MSP, why did you decide to apply and be considered to stand in Falkirk East instead?
Ah, now that's a vicious question from this guy. I mean, that's correct. I did grow up there, and actually, Clydebank and Milngavie is obviously Clydebank. But they've missed off a wee bit in the title of that. It's Clydebank, Milngavie, and Bears Den North. And I grew up in...
Milngavie.
You'll be able to walk around your house tonight. Milngavie. Yeah, that's where I grew up. Actually in the Bears Den North area. And I joined the SNP there when I was 16. You know, and I have to say at that point, it wasn't a huge kind of selection of people. And it's now, you've got a Bears Den North and you've got a Bears Den South. I would have loved to have stood there. And although the SNP says you can elect to stand in up to two constituencies, ultimately I had to make a choice. And the way I chose to approach it was to have private conversations with the office bearers of each of the branches and key individuals, elected representatives and so on, in both of the constituency and find where the best fit was. So I have a deep emotional connection with Clydebank and Milngavie, but when I spoke to everybody, I felt on balance and with a great deal of difficulty that on balance it was better to go for Falkirk East.
Okay, well, I hope that sufficiently answers the question to reduce the outrage. Why do Scottish politicians never challenge Westminster about the amount of resources and funds that are extracted from Scotland when they tell us that we're too poor and too stupid?
I mean, they do. They do challenge them, but again, it's the way in which they challenge them, the kind of the narrative. What we've got at the moment is a fairly simplistic debate, and a lot of it's framed around GERS, the Government Expenditure and Revenue Scotland, which we know there are significant issues for. And incidentally, the whole game's a bogey anyway, given the issues coming out of COVID. And, you know, we've just been throwing money at things. But some of the subtleties within that, where we're told the amount of exports, you know, that goes to the European Union, for example, we've never really dug deeper into the figures to try and estimate how much trade that actually directly comes from Scotland but is acclaimed as accruing to the rest of the UK's balance sheet, if you like. And I'd like to see some more working those numbers and starting. And going back to what you were saying from an academic perspective, where we've got our best brains looking at that, we do have some very fine economists starting to revisit. I mean, I don't necessarily understand why we allow ourselves to go through the kind of thing of jairs every year. Oh, but you get more.
The thing is, I don't believe that Scots have access. Maybe I'm wrong, but do they have access to the raw data? I mean, that would be something.
Well, part of the problem is that some of the raw data is collected, but much of the raw data is estimates, and estimates based on Scotland's population share. And they're completely fatuous, of course, because that assumes that if we had a choice, we would choose to spend 8.3% of, say, on defence, when, of course, we're not given that choice. So it's a completely fatuous exercise. But again, it's about making that real. I would personally like to understand the figures of how much actually should be accruing to Scotland's balance sheet and starting to work up those numbers. But in my view, they do challenge it, but it's quite a dry subject, perhaps, for the media to report. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's interested in that sort of thing. I personally am, but not everyone is.
All right. Well, I guess we'll begin to wrap this up. I think we've gotten most of the questions. But in terms of strategy for getting, I mean, I know I'm kind of tooting my horn here, but do you think that it's impossible that the Scottish government would embrace the covenant as a means for independence? Or do you think that there's...
It's not impossible. What I'm saying is, in my humble opinion, you know, and I'm bearing in mind that I'm absolutely needy, I've got no power or influence or anything like that. In my opinion, I would suggest that it is unlikely, based on the evidence that we have of what they'd be seeking, the so-called gold standard. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying to you is that shouldn't diminish your efforts, because
it's certainly not going to.
That we have to our bow that demonstrate democratic legitimacy, that allow our voices to be heard, the better. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing I would say is there are so many variables, so many moving parts at the moment, particularly Brexit coming down the track at the end of January, COVID, post-COVID.
Into December.
You know, things are going to be really rather interesting. And the truth is, none of us know. So in the light of that, what should we be doing? We should be absolutely redoubling our efforts. I think our yes groups should be really, really organising. I think they should be holding street stalls every Saturday from here on in. I think we should be in campaigning mode. That is the way I feel. That's what I'm in. In fact, perhaps I would argue I've not really stopped. Somebody said to me, how do you think it'll feel being back in politics if I were to be successful? And I said, well, frankly, I've never really been away.
I never stopped.
No, I think once you've opened the door.
Same here. I mean, I'm still, even though I'm, a Scots-American living in France, I just have completely undimmed enthusiasm and effort to see what could happen. Because a couple more things regarding your answer about thanks, Michelle. That's the first time an MSP has answered, well, former MP, hopefully MSP, had answered that question. It's important MPs stand up and say Scotland's a wealthy country. It gives the unionist ammo.
We need to be articulating that wealth. And in fact, in fairness, I think the SNP does that. I mean, if you read the programme for government, the terminology it's using, and it's not just wealth in material terms, it's wealth in what we have in our people, in our intellectual talent. We talked about technology earlier. We are an extraordinarily blessed country, and perhaps arguably the best we have is our people. We are amazingly unique. And if you go and look at the research that Roger and I did, some of the things that people were saying from all around the world, from the outside looking in, they commented invariably that perhaps we lacked confidence in ourselves, and we need to start to change that. I mean, it was certainly a very, very interesting insight into how our diaspora.
That's always been my analysis. I mean, when I first got involved, I just thought that independence would be such a no brainer. It's like you produced Adam Smith, David Hume. I mean, James.
Exactly, and I can feel like we should be jumping.
And you can't govern yourselves. I mean, what's going on? I mean,
some of it, some areas of Scotland. I mean, I lived for quite a long time in Edinburgh. I don't live there anymore. People are quite reserved. and quite conservative with a small C. It takes a long time to change a culture, because I do also think that we have got a chronic lack of self-confidence. And I used to talk about it in the last independence referendum, how, I mean, I know certainly as a young woman, I was positively kind of told not, in effect, to get ideas above my station, of which getting ideas above my station was to go and have the temerity to go and study music at what was the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama. I was like, you know, who do you think you are going off and doing that?
And that's another thing I noticed about Scottish culture, that if you, I'm sure it's more so that if you're a woman, but even, you know, if you're from a working class family and you want to, I don't know, become a lawyer or something like that, they're like, oh, you're getting too big for your britches. What are you doing? And that's why so many had to leave, including my dad, you know, I mean.
This will be my final word, because I'm going to go and have my pizza. To finish, there's a double-edged sword of we're all Jock Tamson's bairns. From a philosophy, the idea that nobody should get uppity above somebody else, I am a great believer in that. You know, I think humility is a fantastic trait. But the downside of that is when people kind of say, well, I want to further myself, I want to be ambitious, I want to be audacious, people can use that to kind of pull them back down. So I think it's something we all need to be careful of. And I think I would say we need massive, audacious ambition to take us to the next stage. But it's our massive, audacious ambition. You know, we're all just one person, but collectively we can do so much more.
Okay, a couple things had to get in. Love you, Michelle, from Sharon Wayne. Sharon Wynne McIntosh. So.
McIntosh. We're going to have to work on your pronunciation. And before I go, just one last thing of how do you pronounce that word?
Mulgay.
You're getting there. Mulgay.
Real quick, do you also advocate voting SNP 1 and 2 in the upcoming election? If yes, are you angry? What do you think about I think there are other pro-independence parties running on the other list, the regional list rather than the constituency.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone's waiting to see the format, nature, and makeup of them with interest. There's not all that much clarity yet. What we hear is a lot of it being talked about. So what is it that they're for? How exactly will it work? I think everyone is interested in seeing that and hearing more about it. At the moment, it's a lot of talk about it. And again, there is a thing, and people are holding different views about legitimacy. So I think it was Kenny Farquharson, who's a journalist, was suggesting that those seats obtained in that way would be illegitimate. I don't believe that. I don't believe that. You know, we have an objective. As Jim Mather, who was an enterprise minister in Alex Salmond's government, used to say, where's the North Star? The North Star, independence and the betterment of Scotland, all our activities have to be on the North Star.
Okay. On that note, I think that's a wonderful place to leave it. So thank you so much I'll be more than happy to have you back anytime.
Well, thank you very much. And good chatting to you. I had no idea what we were going to talk about tonight, but we've seen to manage.
I got the main points. I wanted to talk about the covenant and the wiki.scottishconstitution.com, but other than that, just let it go where it goes.
Okay. Right. I'm away from a pizza.
This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
And in life, God, radio.